Nisambula Vinaka. You're listening to Pacific Waves from RNZ Pacific. I'm Koroe Hawkins. Coming up,
none of the countries or the Pacific Island countries are likely to benefit from that redistribution.
A new study finds the climate change-induced migration of tuna stocks is threatening the future of Pacific economies.
I had to run, and some of them had their chairs and dealt smashy on the way through, and didn't get very far.
A Tokelau Māori survivor shares his experiences of extensive abuse with the Royal Commission of Inquiry, which wraps up its Pacific investigations. And the return of tourists to the Cook Islands is again having a negative impact on Rarotonga's iconic Moree Lagoon. Tuna-dependent Pacific economies are being threatened by climate change-induced ocean warming, which is pushing tuna populations eastwards and out of their waters. This is according to a new collaborative study by Conservation International and a consortium of technical agencies. The study found that, contrary to previous predictions, the migration might already have begun and that all of the affected Pacific countries stand to lose. In this first of a multi-part series, I'm joined by a panel of experts from some of the collaborating organisations. Kia ora and welcome, everyone. I'll let you introduce yourselves.
I'm happy to start. I'm Johan Bell. I'm the Senior Director for Tuna Fisheries at Conservation International.
I'm happy to go next. I'm Coral Pasisi. I'm the Senior Advisor to the Director General of SPC.
Hi, Koroi. My name is Simon Nicol. I am the Principal Fisheries Scientist at the Pacific Community and Team Leader for the Fisheries and Ecosystem Monitoring Program.
Hi, First Day Lover.
Hey, kia ora. Might as well jump in now. I'm Hugh Walton. I am the Chief Technical Advisor for the Oceanic Fisheries Management Project for the Pacific Island Forum Fisheries Agency.
Thank you, Tomas. Thank you, Hugh. First of all, if someone can explain this study, what is this study and how is it different from previous studies in this space?
Koroi, I'd like to say that this study really was the brainchild of the late Sue Tai, who was the executive director of Conservation International's work in the Pacific Islands in New Zealand. Sue learnt about the projected redistribution of tuna to the east. And she was really the first person that I know of that actually said, well, hang on a minute. This is actually very serious. You know, what if the tuna move out of the combined EEZs of the Pacific Island countries into the high seas? There could be a real climate justice issue here. And that got the whole ball rolling. We had a think tank at the University of Wollongong 2 years ago now. We had representatives from FFA and SPC. The PNA were invited, but unfortunately couldn't attend. Anyhow, to cut a long story short, we had a lot of good people around the table. And we decided at the end of the day that this was a really serious issue, and that we needed to raise awareness of the world about it. And so we committed then to write this paper.
If we can go through some of the key findings, what you found out in doing this study.
Thanks, Johan. So Koroi, a lot of what we've done in the Pacific region over the last decade or more has been to develop up a really thorough understanding of how tuna in particular respond to the environment that they occupy and how climate change and a warming ocean is likely to impact that. Back in around sort of 2010, 2011, we did some very rudimentary modelling around what that impact was going to be. And as Johan mentioned, that gave us the very first indicators of a likely eastwards distribution of tuna under the varying climate change scenarios that were being proposed at the time. And so our most recent work has been to really refine those models to understand that impact at a much higher resolution than what we had previously examined, to also test a whole range of different uncertainties in the climate projections that are made for the future. So that includes both projections if there are no mitigation measures, so that we, you know, it's kind of the business as usual high emissions scenario that the globe persists on, or also the scenario that if we're able to achieve the that the Paris Agreement targets, but also to include a whole lot of uncertainty about how the atmosphere and ocean might warm under each of those scenarios. And so what this work did that I think is really telling, that is different from, or is a real advancement from the previous work, is that when we did that early work and we looked at things in a very coarse resolution, the response that we saw was this easterly movement, but it indicated that there's perhaps some winners and losers in terms of how tuna are distributed within the exclusive economic zones of the equatorial Pacific countries. And so those in the far west were likely to, you know, see less tuna in their EEZs, and those in the central Pacific, such as Kiribati, were likely to see more. What our new modelling is showing, though, is that under the high emissions scenario, or the business as usual scenario, is that the distribution is likely to be so strong, and so strong by 2050, that none of the countries or the Pacific Island countries are likely to benefit from that redistribution, and that most of the redistribution will occur into the high seas in the eastern Pacific Ocean.
Vinaka Simon, and we'll have to leave that there for now, but we'll continue this series on the tuna migration and its impacts on the Pacific economies dependent on tuna in our upcoming episodes of Pacific Waves next week. So do tune in for that. And once they've all been aired, we'll put the complete panel version up on our website, rnzi.com. A Tokelau Māori survivor shares his experiences of extensive abuse and differential treatment whilst in state care and in the care of the Salvation Army. This week is the second and last week of the Abuse in Care Royal Commission of Inquiry Pacific Investigation hearing at the Whale'o Samoa in Māngere. Billy Pukatanu spoke about the key factors which led him to being placed in care, the long-lasting impacts of that abuse, and his ideas for transformative change. Sarah Jane Hopgood with the story.
50-year-old Billy Pukatanu from Porirua grew up in a household filled with violence. He says his earliest childhood memory was looking up at his dad beating up his mum. His mum is bipolar and suffers from schizophrenia, but at the time the family didn't know how to manage her mental illness. Mr. Tanu says that with everything happening at home, he started playing up, missing school and running away from home, and this led him to ending up in Ipuni Boys Home.
That's kind of like a welcome to Ipuni Boys Home. The boys are waiting in their rooms opposite each other, and whatever they got in the hand, you just got to try and run through and make it to the end. So I had to run, and some of them had their chairs and they would smash you on the way through, and didn't get very far. And he got like two or three doors and then I was on the ground.
Mr. Tanu experienced physical, emotional and sexual abuse from residents and staff. He remembers being around 9 years old, despite his record saying he was 12 years old when he went to the home. He says the staff never responded to his complaints about the abuse he was getting.
Staff members would often pick on us. One of them was didn't like Pacific Islanders or Maoris. Well, after a few hidings, after a while, I got sick of it and I'll just approach the staff members and tell them what's been going on. And they'll turn around and laugh it off and reply with a harden up me.
He was in and out of Ipuni for a few years and then later transferred to Arbor House in July 1983, which he remembers clearly because it was his 12th birthday and they baked him a big truck-shaped cake. Mr. Tunnel says it was different to Ipuni Boys Home, where it wasn't full of thugs and gangsters, there was no secure unit and not much physical violence. However, there was sexual abuse that took place there. This next clip is a counsel assisting the hearing, Semise Pohiva, with Mr. Tanu.
And then a lot of what you described about the sexual activity happening at Ipuni also was happening at Arbor House?
Yep, pretty much. First got there, there was only boys, but later on there was a mixture of girls from the surrounding suburbs.
When Mr. Tanu was 14 years old, he went to Hauteville Boys Home, which is a boys' home run by the Salvation Army. In this placement, he experienced physical, sexual and substance abuse and also differential treatment.
I used a lot of stuff like glue and Bostik and Eidos. It just takes me away from all the pain that I've been feeling.
Mr. Tunnel's records throughout his teenage years show that he has been running away from home and stealing, which led him to being placed in multiple state care facilities. When he turned 18 years old and came out of care, he ended up in a gang and did criminal activities and eventually was in and out of jail. There were a few low points in his life, including going through a custody battle where he was worried he was not going to see his children again and the breakup of his marriage.
Bringing a child into the world was, I didn't think I'd have kids. It was a real experience holding a baby, and it really slowed me right down when I started thinking there is a better life out there.
When Mr. Tunnel came out of care and had enough of the system, he had a lot of anger towards God. One day, while still in his 20s, his auntie took him to church. The experience started a whole new journey for Mr. Tunnel.
I started really getting into the Bible and church and asking God for a lot of forgiveness throughout my time in care and everything I've been through. I was no longer had any hatred towards God or anything that anyone had done in the past.
Mr. Tunnel says it's important to him that people know his story, and he hopes it will help stop anyone else from having to go through the same experiences.
The return of New Zealand tourists to the Cook Islands has residents in Rarotonga stewing over the impact it's having on the island's iconic Moree Lagoon. A Lagoon spokesperson claims 90% of Moree's many hotels and resorts rely on sewage systems not fit for purpose in preventing chemical and microbe contamination. Dominic Godfrey reports.
Florence Sime Buchanan lives in idyllic Ngatangia, a village on the shores of Moree. The Lagoon spokesperson says the onshore breeze has changed since tourists arrived back in paradise, and hotel wastewater systems are once more failing to cope. She claims the government has been ignoring the issue since Moree was declared a national disaster in 2015.
From the time we were declared, Moree Lagoon was declared a national disaster, that status has never been removed. So it is still a national disaster, but it has never been given the attention that it needs. Moree Lagoon disappears, and that's $50 million that, you know, we can say goodbye to.
That's what Moree brings in from tourism annually. Ms. Sime Buchanan says most hotels on Moree don't have adequate sewage treatment, and water culverts are flooding sediment into the lagoon. She says officials came to a recent village meeting and acknowledged their concerns, but did not commit to action. Riparian planting of waterways with vetiver was recommended as a retainer of soils and as a filtration system. The Ngatangia community also want hotel sewage treatment to be compliant with the Health Act.
Right now, 90% of them are not compliant and have not been compliant for quite some time. And I do believe that the government is going to put some pressure on these businesses to become compliant.
Ms. Sime Buchanan says the survival of Moree Lagoon should be incentive enough for them to act, but they've not acted since the 2015 declaration. Local dive business owner Stephen Lyon claims the only way to save Rarotonga's Moree Lagoon from pollution is a reticulated sewage system. His Pacific Divers depends on a clean marine environment and tourists who don't want a murky algal-blooming waterway. But the marine scientist says a proposal by the New Zealand firm GHD is also problematic as it includes a shallow ocean outfall beyond the reef.
It needs to go deep. It needs to go beneath the surface layer of water, down to where the water is cooler and it's not mixing with the surface layer. And then once it's down there, it's going to have negligible impact on our surface layer. And deep water discharges are used in some places around the world, and I believe they're used effectively.
Stephen Lyon says the government and community need to act to save the lagoon. But he says agreements needed on what level of water purification goes into an ocean outfall.
So if you have a high level of treatment and you denutrify the water before you're disposing of it, then impact is significantly reduced, but it also increases the cost significantly of treatment. So that really has to be weighed up and discussed, I think, as one of the key points to deciding how you'd move forward with a deep ocean outfall or any kind of ocean outfall.
He says the government's supportive of the need, but is grappling with timing and funding due to a water network infrastructure project on island, which is running behind and way over budget. COVID-19 has also left the country with significant debt to service. But an environmental engineer from New Zealand says there's a cheaper way to deal with human waste that's also easier on the environment. Ecogents Peter Riddell had been in Rarotonga to work on a project upgrading septic tank systems.
With that sort of treatment, you'd polish the water up and then use it to irrigate. So rather than disposing of it to groundwater, it would irrigate plants and potentially get some benefits out of it. This is a worm-based system where worms substantially break the solids down, so you end up with a compost that can go on the land.
Mr. Riddell had worked on a similar project in Omaha in Aotearoa, where the community was looking at an ocean outfall. They managed to convince the council to treat the waste and irrigate the land with the recycled water, which was in short supply. He adds that demand for water from hotels on Rarotonga has caused shortages for crop growing.
A lot of the wetlands are pretty well not growing taro and so on as they used to because of the dry seasons and diversion of water for the water supply system on the island. So we're actually sort of recycling a resource that can be usefully used.
He'd been invited to present to key infrastructure people in Rarotonga to show them what can be done, and in turn hosted them at Omaha to show the large-scale council project there. The response had been positive, but he believes had been stymied by previous commitments to more costly solutions and aid deals having been signed off with the New Zealand government.
Relative to the solution on the table, cost is not an issue. And it's only New Zealand aid that's, or aid of any type that really allows these things to happen in some respects.
Peter Riddell makes the point that an ocean outfall is shifting the problem beyond the reef to where the island's fish supply comes from, creating potential further issues. Meanwhile, the villagers of Ngatangia want action from the government to help save Muri Lagoon.
And that's Pacific Waves for today. Remember, you can listen to us free on Apple, Spotify, iHeart or any podcast platform. And if you're using Apple, please leave us a rating and review so others can also find us. Until next time, mo te manawa.